How many people here have accepted Jesus Christ as their personal Lord and Savior? Let's have a show of hands. You don't have to be embarrassed if you haven't. Who gives a rip? I mean, I'm glad it works for you. But my God isn't like that. I haven't accepted Christ. I don't need your God. You have your religion and I have mine. You got your truth and I have mine. I'm happy with my God. I like where my life's going. Hey, listen, I can be good too, and I don't need your God to do it. And that's because all religions are simply different paths to the same thing. You got a right to believe what you want to believe, but just don't push your values on me. And then you say, but. And that is the subject of the next five times that I'm going to talk, including this time right here. This series is entitled Worldview Wars or Who Gives a Rip? Okay? You know, there are any number of entry points into a conversation like the one that I brought up that could be a typical response. I have discovered in all the years that I have watched these debates and arguments go on, agnostic and atheistic intellectuals are just terrific at asking all of the hard questions, especially college professors. They're good at it. They have it honed to an art. The questions are hard-hitting. They're succinct. They drive you into a corner, and they themselves are lousy at providing any answers whatsoever. They are actually proud of the fact that they can ask the hard questions to which they believe there are no answers, and they actually even in some cases ridicule those people who attempt to provide an answer as they verbally slice up their opponents and serve them for dinner. Now, there's no reason for this to happen. Their students fail to notice that despite the magnificent display of cutlery, which is chopping them up, there's nothing on the plate to eat. An effective Christian response often determines the difference, but oftentimes the answer fails to win people, or worse, a Christian even loses his faith as the conversation or time progresses. Christian teens and post-teens are falling away from Christianity at a 50 to 80% rate, depending on which survey is taken and which faith they are in and what kind of training they have prior to entering college. After they enter college, a good portion fall away within the first 6 months, the first year, and definitely by the end of 4 years, the first time they are confronted by agnostic and atheistic professors who make seemingly good arguments against God and their faith, years of verse-by-verse Bible study just don't seem to give them the answers they need. And it is a tragedy, because Christians really do have the hardball answers to the hard questions today. I can even make the claim that I believe it's the only worldview that has the answers to the really tough questions. But Christians have no idea what the questions are. And so they always provide the wrong answers to the right questions. They go into battle. They're given a sword. The sword is the word of God. But they're never told how to use it. This is especially true of young people in our churches, evangelical churches, fundamental churches. And so when the Bible encounters the philosophies of the world, the result is almost always disaster. They're told if you just grab this sword and swing it around your head wildly and hope you hit something, it'll work. Doesn't do it. And what we've needed in the evangelical church, I call them FEPs, Fundamentalist Evangelical Pentecostal. That puts it in one big bailiwick so we can talk about it, right? Some people call it the Bible-believing churches. But in the FEP churches, what we have needed is apologetical training. We desperately need it. It's not enough just to study the Scriptures. Now you have to apply the Scriptures, and you have to understand into what atmosphere and ambience you are applying those Scriptures. That is not being done. Only a few ministries out there are doing that today. Josh McDowell has been doing it. Ravi Zacharias has been doing it. He does it from a very academic level. Francis Schaeffer did it for as long as he lived on the earth. There are smaller people, I mean not lesser people, but I mean not as well-known people that are out there. And also Dave Noble at Summon Ministries, who spoke at Stealing the Mind last year, has, I believe, a 6-week course for teens that are just about ready to go into college. so that they hit the college armed. But beyond that, it just doesn't seem to be a high priority for pastors and churches. And another pizza party and another lock-in and another Bible study will not solve the problem. Christians are constantly caught in a seemingly defenseless position because they have no training in apologetics. They don't understand the basis for their faith, and typically one of three things happens. One, they lose some or all of their faith. They become confused, and they begin adopting other beliefs into their belief system. Two, they retreat irrationally into their faith, their Bible shell, or I call it a shtetl. You know what a shtetl was? Remember, it was a Jewish community in Eastern Europe in the 19th century and early on. And the Jews would build a wall up. You know, you always wondered what went into the shtetl, the same as the Warsaw Ghetto. So Christians quite frequently in this century have been building shtetls for themselves, condemning everything that's outside the wall, maybe lobbing some firebombs out from time to time. As Ken Ham likes to point out, Christians always aim at the superficials. The other side's been aiming at the foundations. It's time that we start pointing at the foundations, because their foundation's on sand. Ours is on rock. But we've just been aiming at the wrong thing. And the third possibility, they act as if stupidity were a virtue and say very stupid things in response to very serious questions from people, further discrediting the faith in their opponent's eyes. Something happened at Stealing the Mind about 3 or 4 years ago. The gentleman Bill Perkins has do audio every year is a really neat guy to work with if you're into audio and broadcasting and all of that. His name is Mike. Mike's not a believer. Bill's been talking to him for years. I mean, he's liberal, he's left-wing, not a believer, cares about his kids, family, you know, intelligent man. And I was back in the audio booth there, which is really the penalty box because it was a hockey, you know, it's a ice skating ring. But anyway, we're back in the penalty box. And I hear out of the corner of my mind, or my ear, I hear Mike talking to a young man who is a believer in his mid-20s. And Mike turns to him and says, well, you know, I've got some real problems with things that Christians believe. Now, this, my ear went like this, okay? All right, because this was a terrific invitation. This is an open door. And I was waiting to hear the response. And I heard this young man say, well, Mike, you just can't come to Jesus with your head. You just have to come to him with your heart. My reaction, which I reflected on later, without even a moment's hesitation, I spun around and blurted out, that is absolutely untrue! And I pulled him out of the conversation before he could do any more damage. In one afternoon, he could wreck what Bill Perkins had been doing for a decade. I guess it didn't help I'd been reading Francis Schaeffer on the same thing all during that time. Let me explain to you why this is important. I'm going to read from two different passages of Scripture and we'll show how Paul dealt with this. If you have your Scriptures, you can read along. We'll flip over to Acts 17, right around there. It's the day Paul showed up in Greece and showed up in Athens. And therefore Paul disputed in the synagogue with the Jews and with the devout persons and in the market daily with them that met with him. And then certain philosophers of the Epicureans and of the Stoics encountered him. And I'm going to give you a narration as we go here. The Epicureans and the Stoics were two predominant philosophies of the Middle East at that time in the ancient world, along with the Pythagoreans and the Aristotelians, various belief systems. That is why when Jesus said to Pontius Pilate, I am the way, the truth, and the life, Pilate went, I mean, it was really sarcastic when Jesus said, I got the truth. And Pilate, oh, for Pete's sake, that's all I ever hear. Everybody's running around babbling, we've got the truth. That's why Pilate said what he said. A lot of Christians don't understand why that knee-jerk reaction on the part of Pontius Pilate. And some said, what will this babbler say? He seems to set forth strange gods because he preached unto them Jesus and the resurrection. And so they took him and brought him up to the Areopagus, saying, may we know what this new doctrine is of which you speak? Now understand, the Areopagus was a part of Athens at the time where all of the debating was done. It was like a public forum. And everybody was up there. It sort of reminds you of San Francisco or Boulder, Colorado. If you go to the mall in Boulder, Colorado, or the mall in Berkeley, this kind of stuff went on all the time. Everybody was hawking everything you can think of in the way of religion and philosophy. So they invited Paul up here. He says, because you bring strange things to our ears and we want to know what these things mean. For all the Athenians and strangers which were there spent their time in nothing else but either to tell or to hear some new thing. See? It's Gossip Central, and failing the internet, they had to do it at one place in the town. So that was it. So Paul stood in the midst of Mars Hill, and he said, now, Paul's trying to find the little crack. In other words, when Mike spoke up and said, I've got some problems that things about you Christians believe, the next question should have been, okay, you know, I do too, Mike. Tell me, what are your problems? And you sit and you listen, because he's opening himself up to you. And then you are in a position to address it. So Paul's trying to do the same thing right here. Then Paul stood in the midst of Mars Hills and he said, men of Athens, I perceive that in all things you are too superstitious. For as I passed by and beheld your devotions, I found an altar with this inscription, to the unknown God, whom therefore you ignorantly worship, him I declare to you. God that made the world and all things therein, seeing that he is the Lord of heaven and earth, does not dwell in temples made with hands. Now bear in mind, he's talking to people who are generally pagans and idolaters, right? There are gods all over the place in Athens. So he's trying to work them over to this. Okay, you got the altar to the unknown God. Let me tell you about this God. Neither is worship with men's hands as though he needed anything, seeing that he gives to everything life and breath and all things. And he has made of one blood all nations of men to dwell on the face of the earth, and has determined the times before appointed and the bounds of their habitation, that they should seek the Lord if they haply might feel after him and find him, though he is not far from every one of us. Now, what's the appeal that he's making here? These Greeks have never, ever, ever heard of the Torah. So he's saying to them, nevertheless, all you had to do is seek for him, and you will find him. For in him we live and move and have our being, as certain also of your own poets have said, for we are also are his offspring. For as much then as we are the offspring of God, we ought not to think that the Godhead is like gold or silver or stone cut by art and man's device. And the times of this ignorance God winked at, but now commands all men everywhere to repent, because he's appointed a day in which he will judge the world in righteousness by that man whom he hath ordained, whereof he hath given assurance unto all men in that he hath raised him from the dead. Well, he just went over the trip point. Now, a trip point's a part of in an argument. If you're trying to lead somebody a given direction, it's like towing a car. There comes a point when the rope is going to break. That's a trip point in any discussion. And when you're engaging in conversation with somebody, you don't want to make, you try to avoid the trip point. Because if they start to move with you in the conversation, you don't hit it. But if you go too far and too fast, it breaks. You get the what we call the woo-woo look. You know, woo-woo, you know, like that. Okay, that's the woo-woo look. All right. When they heard of the resurrection of the dead, some mocked, and others said, we will hear again of this matter. So, okay, that's it. Out he went. And so Paul departed from among them. Now, here's the priceless verse. Nevertheless, several men cleaved to him and believed, among which was Dionysius the Areopagite and a woman named Damaris and others with them. You're never going to get everybody. Jesus didn't get everybody. The apostles didn't get everybody. No how, no way. But some of them, it caught and it listened. But he was trying to make an appeal to reason to begin where they were and lead them where they needed to go. That's the important thing. And Paul was probably one of the most equipped persons to do this. When you realize that Peter... Well, I understand the role of the Holy Spirit, but I mean, Peter's worldview was the fish before Jesus got a hold of him, all right? That was it. Like, how about them Broncos, you know? This was Peter's view, and he was what? He was a Jew, and he only understood the Semitic culture in which he had grown up, whereas Paul was ideal. This man was a Renaissance man 1,500 years before the Renaissance, because he was a Roman citizen. That was like a passport. He was educated. He was educated under Gamaliel. As a result of that, he knew Torah and Hebrew backwards and forwards. He spoke Greek, probably Latin. The man understood both cultures. He was the bridge between these two cultures that God needed. And that's why God pulled him. He also understood the world views of his day and what he was up against. But when, if you read his first epistle to the Corinthians, however, chapter 1... start with verse 17 here. Now, this is an interesting observation. For Christ sent me not to baptize, but to preach the gospel, not with the wisdom of words, lest the cross of Christ should be made of no effect. For the preaching of the cross is to them who perish foolishness. See, here's that trip point again. They can't grapple with this. But to us who are saved, it is the power of God. Because it is written, I will destroy the wisdom of the wise, and I will bring to nothing the understanding of the prudent. Where is the wise? Where is the scribe? Where is the disputer of this world? Have you ever engaged in a conversation? Academics are really good at this. Okay, an academic will take a point of reference and run it right into the ground. Nitty pick it down to every shade and color of detail. A few weeks ago, I got a phone call from a lady in the Bronx who listens to my radio show. She's not a believer, and she wanted to clarify some of the things I was saying about the consensus process. And so I listened. And she went and analyzed every single shade of the consensus in this way, and it really meant that, and it came over here, and so, and I was sort of misapplying it over here, and it was probably true over there, and whatever. And, you know, whenever I get to the end of a conversation or listening to a sermon, I always apply the so what test. The so what test is, why did you take my time? And the bottom line was, whether she was right or wrong about all of the shades of meaning and nuances and disputations, the point was the consensus process is still wrecking this culture. Because it's based on a relative value system of no truth. And it's destroying the culture, it's destroying our democracy, it's destroying the churches. Just like Francis Schaeffer warned us about 20 years ago. That's what Paul's talking about, the disputer. There are people who love to dispute for the sake of disputing. They're not trying to go anywhere, they're not trying to find anything, they revel in it. And that's a worthless, it's worthless. Because philosophy and theology have a real valid purpose. And they have a real goal and a real target. And it affects our lives and what we believe and how we believe. It affects what we do, how we live, and the laws we're going to make and the eternity we're going to spend. It has a real purpose. But when it drifts off into nothing but words and quibbling, you're a disputer. And Jesus said the kingdom of heaven consists not in words but in power. It is not those who hear the word of God but those who do it. God always said words are a mean to action. They are not the object in and of themselves. And that's what philosophy and theology always faces that danger of, and that's what Paul is saying here. So he says, where is the disputer of the world? Hasn't God made foolish the wisdom of the world? For after that, in the wisdom of God, the world by wisdom knew not God. It pleased God by the foolishness of preaching to save those who believe. The Jews, they want a sign. The Greeks want wisdom. But we preach Christ crucified. Unto the Jews a stumbling block, and unto the Greeks foolishness. But for those who were called, both Jews and Greeks, Christ the power of God and the wisdom of God, because the foolishness of God is wiser than men, and the weakness of God is stronger than men. Now, some people misinterpret this as saying it's ridiculous to study any philosophy or to know what's going on in the world because this is the truth and that's all we need to know. I don't think he's saying that at all. What he is saying is all of the other philosophies of the world originated with men and are trying to work upwards to God. That is what the naturalistic viewpoint does. That is when we branched off 300 years ago in Western society. We finally said, the world, the universe is a box. The only thing we can ever know is anything that's inside the box. Anything outside the box is strictly a matter of personal faith. That came about as a result of the Enlightenment. And that was the beginnings when we start looking at Voltaire and Robespierre and Rousseau. The French Revolution was probably the event that kicked off the whole new mode of thought. Any time since that time that somebody has had a great utopian vision for the world, a lot of people started dying. It was the same worldview that propelled Marxism. It's the same worldview that propelled secular humanism. It's the same worldview that played a large role in the foundation of Nazism. Although Nazism does have a religious component. And the new socialism into which the world is being thrust, the Western world, does have a religious component. It will seek to co-opt the church. It will not leave the church alone. Secular humanism, to a certain degree, left the church alone. So where are we going with all of this? Okay, everybody, you may want to run to see your doctor after I tell you this. Everybody has a Weltanschauung. It's a German word. As bad as it sounds, you can't get rid of it. It's not curable. Good, bad, sloppy, or formal, you have one. Now, in English, we've translated that into worldview. It's really a neat German word. Germans love to glue words together. That's one of the few languages of the world that does it. Welt means world. Schauen means to look. Anschauen means to look at. Ung is the same as ing. So it's a world at looking, which translates a world view. Everybody's got one. Some of them are sloppy. Some people don't think very deeply about it. Some of them just sort of think it's the next beer, the next Broncos game. The goal of any philosophy or religion is really to answer several basic questions about our worldview. And the questions are, who are we? Where did we come from? Where are we going? What shall we do while we're here? And is there a higher power? And probably the most important question is, how do I know it? How do I know what I know? The last question is the Christian scrambler. Christians don't have an answer. And God says so doesn't really cut the intellectual mustard when you talk to people who don't believe that God exists. They're not going to take the word of the God who doesn't exist for their answer. So what we have is we have a situation where the non-believers are standing over here in their worldview. The believers are over here. And we have a huge chasm that has opened up between us over the last 40 years here, since World War II. It began earlier than that. Early on in the century, with Humanist Manifesto number 1 and John Dewey, the humanists declared war on the church. In Humanist Manifesto, they said, 1, there's been a Humanist Manifesto 2, and I think there's a 3 that's just come out. They said they were going to take over the organs of social culture, academics, media, not by a conspiracy, not by a revolution. They were simply going to use these organs to completely change the belief of the culture. They declared war on Christianity. They said they were going to knock it off its Judeo-Christian base. And frankly, they have succeeded. The church just yawned and watched it go on by as they completely transformed primary education, college, the media, and now it's flowing through politics. What you saw happen in the elections in Florida was the direct result of Humanist Manifesto 1 almost 75 years ago. Because if it depends on what your definition of is, you're in trouble. The Supreme Court of Florida, it was great, I gave this part of this talk in Florida about a week and a half ago. I said, you guys hear about the ruckus down in Florida? You know, the judicial activism is a direct result of the belief in no absolute truth. If you have judges who are strict constructionists, they believe that the text means what it says it means within the definitions of language. There are always what we call problems with language. Language is never precise. It is never absolute. And the only language that ever really counts is what was in the mind of the speaker when the speaker speaks. But nevertheless, we can achieve a certain level of precision. That's what the art of semantics is all about, and I'm talking about positive semantics, rather than playing with words to try to invert them. That's where God warns against that. God tells us, woe unto those who call evil good and good evil. You know, this horrible distortion of language that we have seen go on even in our country. And it's not just our country, it's going on throughout the Western world right now. But it's a direct result of the humanistic worldview that there is no such thing as absolute truth, that all truths are in a constant state of change. And that the process, this is the consensus process, the process and the outcome are more important than the details in getting there. And so when we had a situation in Florida where you had a Supreme Court stacked with judges who adhere to this philosophy, they just made up law right out of thin air. There was not a single statute they could stand upon for the decision they made about extending the vote count deadline. It was the U.S. Supreme Court that came in and slapped their hands in legalese and said, please, just show us one statute that you're making this decision on. But this is what we're facing right now. You see, at one time in Western culture, and the decay started about 75 years earlier in Europe than it did here. It started into Europe in about 1850 and was probably complete by about 1900. It really didn't start here till about 1900 and was the process of change was really kicking into gear about 1935. It took a while to come across the ocean. But originally at one time here, let's just take the United States, or even Canada, if we have people listening on tape in Canada. We had a common worldview. It was basically based on the Judeo-Christian worldview, the sense of morality, the sense of law. The laws were made which adhered to the Judeo-Christian viewpoint. Our debates, whether it was in Congress or various legislatures or Parliament in Canada or elsewhere, were simply over the issue of how we were going to carry out that worldview. Now, what has been happening in the last 20 years is the fact that we have two worldviews now that are competing for the death, for the control of the culture. We are no longer debating over common things and common goals. That is why any description of common ground is absurd. Walter Williams a few weeks ago made a comment when he was substituting for Rush Limbaugh. He said, there is no common ground. And my ears went like that. I said, finally, somebody's got the guts to say it. There's no common ground. We're not going to find any common ground. There are a few issues we could agree on, but there's no common ground because we start from different viewpoints, we're traveling in different directions, and we're not going to wind up at the same place. We don't have hardly any values in common. That is the worldview that is the fight that's underway today. Your Weltan Schauung worldview affects everything you are. A worldview, as we said before, seeks to answer the critical questions of life. Who am I? How do I even know I exist? Ever heard the expression, well, we make fun of it now, I bark and therefore I am? Okay, that was a solution on the part of Rene Descartes, and he was a Christian, to resolve the issue of how do I know I even exist? How do we know what we know? And he figured, well, okay, in order to know something, I have to exist to know that I know something. He figured he could at least start from that viewpoint. There are some other corollaries when we ask to God, is there meaning in life? And the second corollary that I would like to deal with later in the evening, very briefly, because we'll deal with it in future weeks, why is there so much evil in the world? If there's really a God out there, they would ask you, why is there so much evil in the world? Reminds me of Young Frankenstein. You ever see that movie? A riot is not a pretty thing, but I think it's just about time we had one, you know. All religions of the world try to answer these questions. All of them. So who are the competitors now that we're up against? And understand that what I'm doing tonight is laying the groundwork for the next few weeks that we're going to deal with these issues when I jump into them. Okay, well, first of all, the competitors are other religions. What are the principal other religions that are out there? Well, we have the monotheistic religions. We take Judeo-Christianity because we're pretty much in the same ballpark. And I'm talking about traditional Judaism, not Reform Judaism. Reform Judaism and similar have sold out to the worldview of today, just as mainline denominations of Christianity are selling out to the worldview of today, and large chunks of Roman Catholicism have sold out to the worldview of today. We may not have agreed with the Catholics back then. We surely don't agree with that crowd now. Okay, there are other monotheistic religions. There is Islam. Islam came along 600 years after Christianity. It is a compendium it started with some of the pantheistic religions of the East. Al-Ilah, the moon god, Muhammad threw out the rest of them. He took some Christian belief, some Jewish belief, smashed it all together. That's where he got Islam. There is also another monotheistic religion, the Sikh religion. If you ever go into a quick stop and you see a man there who talks like he comes from another part of the world, all right, his name doesn't have to be Apu either. So, but if he has a turban on, he's most likely a Sikh, not a Hindu. Okay, it is a monotheistic religion. But their concept of monotheism is not as personal as we have. And it was an offsprout of the Hindu religion of about 500 or 600 years ago. What's the other contender? Well, the other major contender out there is Hinduism and its component Buddhism. Buddhism was an offsprout of Hinduism. The Buddha himself noticed that there was all this pain, suffering, and transitoriness in the world that generates in what the philosophers call in us angst. Angst is a German word again, and it means anxiety. Only it doesn't just mean sort of fretting. It means this gnawing, gut-wrenching, ucko feeling in your stomach that something is radically wrong. And he noticed that life was transitory and short. And then he developed his own way. But that's why there's so much similarity between Buddhism. And Buddhism itself has broken up into various sects as it spread out. And they have different thrusts and different belief systems. You know, though you're talking about Tibetan Buddhism. We're not doing a course here in Eastern religions. The other major religious competitor is pantheistic religion. And to sound like a little oversimplification, whether you take a pantheistic religion from Indonesia or from Native American areas here or South America or wherever, they're all pretty much the same thing. The world is full of evil spirits that need to be placated through various ceremonies, etc., etc., etc. There is haunting similarity of all the pantheistic religions that we see around the world. Those are your religious competitors that are out there. They've always been there. And they do, to a large degree, provide some satisfying answers to some of the hardball questions of life. Hinduism basically has your ultimate continuing reincarnation under the law of karma. If you perform your duty, your dharma, well, then your karma gets better, and you know how that cycle goes. And ultimately, you achieve a state of nirvana, at which point you are subsumed into that which is all. In other words, the sublime. Buddhism is not far off of that. Now, the other competitors that came about as a result of the Renaissance period, which moved up through the Enlightenment and onwards, is a belief that was championed by a guy by the name of Hegel, who is supposedly a Christian. I got a rough email from somebody because we wrote something in the update on this whole process, and he said, oh, Hegel was a Christian, and he may have been, but he set in action the process. Here's the problem that they finally had coming out of the Renaissance period. The problem was, how do we know that there is a God, or what is going on in goddom, shall we say, all right? In the kingdom where God reigns, wherever that happens to be. Before, we always believed that if, say, this is the box, there's the universe, like right here, and everything in the universe is inside the box, but God is outside the box, at least as far as his dwelling place, because where he inhabits eternity, outside space-time, right? But he talks to things inside the box. He sent his son into the box at one point as a man to share in space-time and to do what we couldn't do. Because of the new emerging philosophies out there, many of which were anti-Christian, and frankly, Christians at some point deserved it. When Voltaire wrote his satires of the Catholic Church of his time, a lot of it was well-deserved. If you ever read Candide, that was one of the more egregious ones. I always remember the great line from Candide where they were having the Inquisition, and somebody asked this lady, how did you like the Inquisition? She said, oh, it was wonderful. They served refreshments to the ladies between the Mass and the executions. You know. So it was not without justification. But what they did is they finally said, if we're going to be scientific about this whole thing, we can only know those things that are inside the box. We have to be able to start inside the box and work outward if we're going to prove it. Well, they have failed. That's probably the most exciting part of secular humanism. Secular humanism has failed to answer any of the hardball questions of life that need answering. And as such, people are drifting away from it now, which is a plus, but they are also drifting towards this new form of global pantheism. And something I will go through next week or the time after is the steps that people go through as they reject God. Almost every culture has ever gone through this type of thing. But basically, they said we have to be able to start inside the box and work outwards. If there's a God, we should scientifically be able to prove it. And anything we can't prove doesn't exist or is only a matter of personal belief. That is the core belief which you are fighting today if you try to witness to somebody. Because it says that anything involving faith or belief is, number one, personal. Number two, it's a matter of feeling. Number three, it's not related to fact. And number four, it's separate and different for every one of us. I have my truth, you have your truth. Try fighting uphill against that one. It's like trying to nail jello to the wall. That's why you can't even dispute on a reasoned level with people. Because when you finally get them cornered, and remember, the goal in a dispute or just discussing with them is always to win the heart, not the argument. But sooner or later, you got to hit it home. They don't care. It just off it goes. So it's a diabolical belief system because you can't get to it. And the people over there think they're okay. And in reality, they feel good about knowing nothing because that's what an agnostic says. Now, that doesn't mean to make fun of the people who are there. They're real people. A lot of them are very sincere, but they're very confused and very lost. And the tragedy is, while there may be some formal atheists and agnostics up here who have well developed what they believe, the tragedy is the average person down here who was the recipient of that philosophy as a result of their years in educational systems around the country that have picked up a bit here and a bit there, and they don't know why they believe this and they don't know why they believe that. And as such, they're really lost. That's one of the questions that atheists will ask of us. You know, they talk about the problem of evil, right? Well, do you believe that people who don't accept Christ go to hell? Well, now, this is a real gut-wrenching question. Because I got an email from a guy who said, I was a Christian once, but I had a hard time believing in a God who would send people to hell. You know, all these people, that just because they didn't accept Christ. Have you ever looked at how people live when they don't have Christ? And you can do this in every single culture. They're really messed up. We have some family connections with people who live on Easter Island. You don't want to turn your back on some of these people. You go into tribal cultures, it is not the gentle native which the New Agers have been trying to put upon us. It's a downright vicious dog-eat-dog world. Every culture has its good points, but every culture has its rough points, and it's full of worshiping false gods and spirits and incantations and rituals. You know what's been amazing? Have you been following the archaeological discoveries here in the Americas? You remember how we assumed that people came across the Asian bridge between Asia and Alaska and then populated the Americas down this way. They've been making some interesting discoveries. As they find more and more grave sites, they've now had forensic people work on this, and they've reconstructed their face. They look Caucasian rather than Asian. This was a rattler once the technology came along that we were able to do that and say, what did this person really look like when they were here? The second thing was, and I saw this on a PBS or a National Geographic, as they said, what has really distressed them is the fact that every one of these people died violently. They've got axe holes in the head, somebody smashed them in the head or whatever. And all of a sudden, remember, we have the Anasazi down in the Four Corners area. If you ever get a chance to, by the way, go to Mesa Verde, the Four Corners, it is worthwhile seeing the cliff dwellings there. But all of a sudden, we've discovered evidence of cannibalism among these people. Let's look at the gentle native of Mexico when we talk about the Aztecs. I love Aztec names. Isn't that neat? They are so hard to pronounce. You work on it. You know that volcano down there they all call Mount Popo? Do you know why they call it Mount Popo? Because its real name is Popocatépetl. Take about 10 minutes working that through to get that one up, you know. Their blood sacrifices were just incredible into the Mayan culture and everywhere else. And so as you begin to look around the world, you realize that God's judgment is really true. See, way back when, we chose to leave God. Okay, we chose to do that. And because He's a God that believes in free will and wants a heart response, His goodness demands that we come back to Him from free will. And He says that anyone who looks for Him, who really tries to find Him, will find Him. And that's what Paul was saying here too. He said, you know, in the olden days when you were really stupid, God sort of winked at it. He let you get away with it. He said, but now He's calling people to an accountability to try to get us back where we walked away from in the Garden of Eden. And we constantly keep walking away from it. Two issues that face us today as we attempt to grapple with what is happening in the worldview wars raging today. We're dealing with them theoretically here tonight. I'm hoping to make them more tangible for you, because I always want to answer the so what test. These philosophies have built or destroyed the lives of millions of people, and they continue in the process of doing so. They affect the eternal destinies of those millions of people. I'm going to reiterate it. The discussion of religion and philosophy is not idle speculation. It has real consequences. The fact that Satan has convinced so many people that they have their truths and we have our truths, and therefore no truth be examined or need be examined because we all create our own truths, is one of the greatest tragedies of our times. What it has really done is constructed a wall of genteel hostility that is very difficult to breach. And so when you're dealing in this type of a mode, you have to try to break the person's commitment to no truth. I don't mean to no truth like you know it. I mean to zero truth. I was out biking around Hayden Lake about 5 years ago, and I paired up with a lady who apparently manages one of the health clubs around here, so I struck up the conversation and pushed it pretty hard over to truth as fast as I could, and sure enough, out came the pre-programmed response. Well, I think it's arrogant of anybody to claim they have absolute truth. Now, what you got to do is, whenever you in a situation like this, you have to lightning rod it. Okay, lightning rod means get it down to brass tacks and get it down quickly, because we could debate absolute truth, but you wouldn't do that. So as we're biking there, I said to her, well, I have a question for you. Do you have a Social Security card? And she said, yes. Now, you understand, actually the question was more like this. Do you have a Social Security card? She said, yes. I said, does it have a number on it? Yes. Is it your number? Yes. Does anybody else have that number? No. Isn't that just a little arrogant of you? Okay. And there's just big pause. Because, you had wham, we just got it down. The funny thing is, using logic that they wouldn't use to buy a 20-year-old Volkswagen, they will trust their eternal salvation and their eternity on that kind of philosophy. And it's not their fault. You can't hammer these people on that. This is the way they have been raised in the public education system. All right, and our job is to rescue them out of that.
The world has shifted from logical and a reasoned way of thinking to a feeling method of thought. Josh McDowell said something 3 years ago that really impressed me. He said he used to be able to go 20 years ago into a college audience and assume he was dealing with a college group of people and assume that they would immediately begin operating on the intellectual plane. And as soon as he began talking about truth, some students said, well, that's arrogant of you to claim that you have the truth. Now, he didn't realize he had just made an absolute statement. But Josh began to realize he had to start with feeling, and he has to move them over in the course of his presentation to reason, because they have no reasoning tools. The world has shifted from a logical and reasoned way to a feeling method of thought. Now, humanism has been unable to answer the critical questions of life. That is why there's a flood of people to other religions and practices, especially pantheism and New Age religions. People nowadays are actively buying their Build-A-God kits. They're making God out what they want to be to solve their problems, to maintain their neuroses, without making any requirements of them. I once talked to a lady who'd had some rough times growing up in her family. The father had some problems with alcohol. The mother had been one of these strict controllers. And this woman had been in therapy for I don't know how long, trying to overcome the hang-ups that she had been in. And she kept telling me about, you know, her mother needed to have come, and they needed to have a reconciliation, and she needed to do this, and her mother needed to do that, and blah, 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 blah. I mean, this went on for quite some time, and you could see how deep the pain ran. And I told her, I said, your mom's never going to do that. I said, and besides, it's affecting your life. You haven't forgiven her. You haven't walked away. You know, you got these shackles. Ebenezer Scrooge type, you know, where Marley shows up. She's still walking with these shackles. And then she begins to, oh no, I'm doing this and it's fine. And my God does this and my God does that. And my God treats me and he loves me so much. So on. And I said, finally, after a while, this like stopped her. I said, guys, question? How is it that your God lets you off so easily, but he won't let your mother off the hook? And I think that was one of the, what I call the driving wedge questions. And it wasn't to make fun. It was to show this contrast, to show that she really hadn't forgiven and she was doing a lot of the same thing. And that's really frustrating to see people caught in that web. See, the hard part about Christianity is, whether we like it or not, we're going to spend all eternity with each other. Oh, dear Lord, no. See, Christ died for everybody except you. All right? He couldn't possibly have wanted to die for you. He wouldn't be that stupid. Okay? And that's what the forgiveness is all about. It's the only answer out there. I'll show you some contradictions, you know. Let me read you something about Francis Schaeffer, then I'll move on. This will sum up what I'm talking about the confusion. Francis Schaeffer said, the tragedy of our situation today is that men and women are being fundamentally affected by the new way of looking at truth, and yet they have never analyzed the drift which has taken place. Young people from Christian homes are brought up in the old framework of truth. That's the biblical framework. Then they are subjected to the modern framework, usually in public school, high school, and college. In time, they become confused because they do not understand the alternatives with which they are being presented. Confusion becomes bewilderment, and before long, they are overwhelmed. This is true not only of young people, but of pastors, Christian educators, evangelists, and missionaries as well. And he wrote that back in probably about 1980. So he understood it. He was sort of a point man that began warning us that we can never adopt this system. Okay, let's look at the Judeo-Christian paradigm, then we'll move on to the humanistic paradigm. And these are very brief tonight. They'll be in a lot more in-depth as we go in the next few weeks. The Judeo-Christian paradigm says there is one independently existing truth, meaning, and I don't want to get into theories of truth. There are various theories of truth that exist in philosophy, and they are valid to talk about them. I always just say, let's wipe them all aside, because the bottom line is, we all believe that truth is basically whatever happens to exist. It's just a question of how we know that. But Judeo-Christianity said there was an existing truth. The debate revolved around what we could know about that truth, what God means in His Word, what His science is telling us. That was where always the debate was. But modern science was founded on the belief that there were absolutes. If there were no absolutes, how could Newton have ever created a law? You see, that's why secular humanism is even debasing of modern science. It's destroying the basis. And at the same time, even though humanists will tell you there are no absolute values, they will cling, like someone defending his theory of the rapture, to evolution. And I'll show you these contradictions in just a sec. Truth exists whether we like it or not. It makes us. We do not make it. This is the Christian viewpoint. Now, since God, truth, and the universe exist with or without us, there are hardball consequences. Since there is a God and a universe, I am not God. I am not the center of the universe, although I would love to be. Since there is a God, he who makes the universe makes the rules and calls the shots. Okay? There is a moral law. I don't care whether you like the fact that there's evil, or the fact that he's chosen to do it this way, or the fact that we live for less than 100 years, or the fact that we have to make a decision, heaven or hell, or all of these things. I may not like that, but that's the way it is. I may not like the law of gravity, but if I step off the top of a 100-story building, I am going down. It's not so much fly as plummet. And therefore, my life must conform to the rules of God in the universe. They do not conform to my rules. And my purpose and existence are derived from outside my own self. And that is the hope that Christianity can offer you and me and everybody else here. The fact that our purpose and our meaning is derived from outside of us. The dialectical paradigm. There are two kissing cousins in the dialectical paradigm. And there are differences. Marxism and humanism. There are no absolute truths. And the truths they believe are constantly changing. My very simplistic definition of the difference between a Marxist and a humanist is that a Marxist is a humanist in a hurry with a gun. Okay? The humanists believe in working through established institutions, much according to the rules of Gramscian Marxism. Antonio Gramsci was an Italian Marxist who was not very well liked in Lenin's Russia. Because he said, you'll never take it over by slamming it from the top down. You have to infiltrate the culture and build it from the bottom up. That is what John Dewey, one of the early humanists, founder of our modern education system, said they were going to do. They were going to start from the bottom and infiltrate, just percolate it up, and each generation they would win more and more and more followers. That's what they have done. The humanist Marxist view believes in what's called the dialectic that says, there is a thesis, this is the truth for today. There is a rival truth that comes up, an antithesis. These two things war with each other, sometimes really, sometimes just in the minds and hearts of men. And then there will be a synthesis, and they will form a new truth. And that truth becomes the new thesis. Since there is no God and no truth, we make our universe, and there are likewise no hardball consequences. Since there is no God, I am God, and better still, I am the center of my universe. Since there is no God, the only rules are the ones I make. I call the shots. I make the moral law. My life must only conform to my rules of the universe, and my purpose in existence can only be derived from my own self and my own creative imagination. Well, okay, let's look at the consequences of that worldview. And frankly, it's more important to know the other worldview than it is to know ours. Know your enemy. Okay, well, let's see what happened here. You can imagine how this thing is when it's going to cut loose. You know, when somebody says they don't like absolute truth, the next time, why don't you say, could I have my money that's in your wallet? You know? Or I would love to do this in a college class. I tell my wife, I'd love to go back to college because I don't need a grade. If I can go back to college, don't worry about the grade, then I can, I can really raise havoc. Okay. And there are young people that are doing this in college that have been trained well. But you know what? It's a game. It's a paper chase in college. It really is. There are some good professors there. There are a lot of people who just couldn't make it elsewhere in life. If we all make up our own rules, what happens when the rules collide? This is what the humanists and their successors already are having trouble with right now. All right. Ultimately, we wind up in chaos. And you know what happened? According to God's ruling on that, evil always prevails. Always. What is the dominant competing Marxist view been? Marxism? Due to Marxism, this little book that came out about 5 years ago in French, Le Livre Noir du Communisme, The Little Black Book of Communism, written by ex-communists, now dedicated liberals. Over 100 million people dead in the 20th century as a result of Marxism's war against religion. 100 million people have been gassed, starved, burned, buried alive, shot, anything you can think of, all in the name of fulfilling this dream. Because if there are no rules, then what happens? The rule of evolution kicks in. And what is that? Survival of the fittest. That's the ultimate downshot of evolution. If there are no absolute truths, how can we know anything absolutely? How can there even be science, since nothing can be known absolutely? The humanists constantly borrow their morality from the Judeo-Christian worldview. Oftentimes, what they say sounds downright Christian until you analyze what it means. For example, they agree that murder is wrong, but they can't agree on what it means to be human, so we can't be sure when we're murdering somebody. The quality of life versus the sanctity of life. Abortion and euthanasia are the core issues in this whole thing. They agree we shouldn't murder, but now it's just a matter of definition as to what life is. When does life start? Does it start at conception? Does it start at 3 weeks, 5 weeks, first trimester, third trimester? How about when it's halfway out the womb? Believe me, a culture that will tolerate taking a fully viable baby and half delivering it, jamming scissors in the back of its head and sucking its brains out will ultimately permit anything. It's just a matter of time. And what is usually known as legal creep. Now, those aren't attorneys, okay? Legal creep is what happens is you kick the door open with one here and you move it on, and before you know it, 10 years down the road, the laws move this way. The humanist believes, remember, that we can start with man and make the world a utopia that we need to do. But you know what? It has never worked. Because any time you crack the door open, even for a good purpose, the flood just comes right in. It's like putting a hole in a dam. You start cracking it, and there's a process called cavitation. It's one of the things that they talk about, rapid evolution. Cavitation occurs. It's the vaporization of water, the conversion of water into water vapor instantly, which occurs at high velocities and high pressures underwater. These little bubbles of steam form as a result of this condition. And when they debubbleize, they go together, and the shock wave they generate when they do this can tear out huge pieces of concrete, can destroy a dam in just a short amount of time if the water's rushing through it. It's called cavitation. It's probably one of the other reasons that the Titanic didn't avoid the iceberg, because they had an undersized rudder. This is a rabbit trail, I'll take you down it for a second. They had an undersized rudder, and when the first officer who was on the bridge that night saw it, you know what he ordered? Reverse engines. Now, that was the worst decision he could have made, because these propellers now are beginning to turn in the opposite direction. They're cavitating, and the water flow over the rudder was virtually destroyed at that point. The odds are, if they had just spun the wheel hard a port, they would have actually done it. It would have been better to have taken the iceberg head on. It would have just done it. As it was, he made the worst decision, and they hit it in the worst possible way. But that's what cavitation is all about. But remember, in humanism, contradictions are unimportant. Humanism has introduced a concerted shift from factual analysis to feelings. As such, for Judeo-Christian people, rules and absolutes are important as we move towards a goal. But the humanist believes rules are unimportant, and only the constantly changing process is important as we move toward what we feel to be an important goal. That's what you saw play out in Florida. It's playing out in courtrooms around this country. It is playing out in hearings, school board meetings, you name it. We'll go into the consensus process in a few weeks, and I'll show you how it is absolutely destroying the culture and destroying our ability to deal with it. The dialectical competitor is the chief competitor for Christianity today and for all of the other religions of the world. It is the dominant philosophy in the Western world, whether you're in Europe, Australia, Latin America, Canada, New Zealand, or the U.S. Now let me show you some contradictions that we have here. I want to show you some of the absurdities that humanists have put themselves into. Everything in the secular humanist world viewpoint is subject to moral creep and radical contradiction. It's a self-destructing viewpoint. It exists only because people can't bear the thought, this is my opinion, of going back to God. I mean, we've cut ourselves loose on this path. We said we were going to find, remember when we started out with science back in the 19th century, science was going to disprove religion. going to disprove the existence of God. Science would provide us with everything that we needed. Well, science has failed to do that. Science is good. It's God's science. It's just that science has now reached the limits of as far as it can go, and they haven't gotten the answers. And if you read some of the right books, there's a certain amount of panic in the scientific community, because I remember reading one book, and they said the fundamentalists are closing in fast. Okay? Because what's happened is the fundies, you know, the FEPs, have stopped defending our viewpoint and start asking the hard questions over there. And that's where the issues are getting really hard. Evolution is beginning to creak and groan under its own weight because more evidence comes out, just like the global warming controversy. That's a whole product of consensus, not scientific data. And maybe we'll go into that in a few weeks. Anyway, let me show some of the absurdities that we hear as a result of the floating moral value. Over the last, 8 years, we've heard the new value of tolerance. This is substituted for love and freedom to speak. It's tolerance. It says, we must tolerate everyone. Okay, we must tolerate everyone. Okay, well I have a question. What are you going to do if you run into somebody that doesn't believe in your viewpoint of tolerance? We won't tolerate that! Okay, absurdity number two. You shouldn't push your values on others. Then why are you pushing that value on me? Absurdity number three. We mustn't discriminate against others. Well, what are you going to do? Well, we'll discriminate against them. And here, this has real serious applications. Let me show you why. One of the chief objections to a Christian worldview in the existence of God is, if there is a God, how come there is so much evil in the world? You're going to hear that over and over and over and over and over again. Now, the mistake they're making in that assumption to start with, let me show you what the mistake is. The mistake is because you don't like the consequences, therefore something can't be. Now, try that in real life, okay? Step off a high building. I don't like the consequences. I can think of all sorts of things in my life that I don't like the consequences to that doesn't make them unexist. But here's the dilemma they're in. If there is no God, how do you know what is evil and what is good? Think about it. If there is no God, then anything that is simply is. It isn't good. It isn't bad. It just simply is. So they put themselves in a hopeless loop here. I don't believe in a God because he's good. But you don't know what's good if there isn't a God. But if there is a God, then he tells you what's good and what's bad. And since you've admitted that there is a God and he tells you what's good and bad, you can't call bad what he calls good and good what he calls bad. See? They've got themselves in a really hopeless conundrum there. But nevertheless, you will hear that argument. And to be honest with you, the problem of evil is a real gut-wrenching problem. If there is a God, how can we have so much evil? And there are some answers to that. Number one, an all-loving God loves us. Because he loved us, he gave us free will. We use that free will. First, our forefathers in the form of Adam and Eve used that free will to rebel. We ourselves have continued to rebel to this day. God said that affects two things. It affects our lives, it affects the people around us, and the second thing is, it has even affected the creation, because Paul says all of creation is groaning for redemption. Why? Because we fell. Do you realize that if you didn't have darkness, you wouldn't know what light was? So evil is almost the pathos and driving engine in which we can actually put perspective on God's love. And because of his love, he let us commit evil. Otherwise, it would have been Robbie Robot. Why would it have been fun for him to create a creature that just, you know, John, do this. Yes, master. As you wish. He wanted free response from us. And so he allowed evil. And why? Well, he tells us his wisdom is so much higher than ours, we're not going to reach it. So once again, whether we like the existence of evil or not, that is not necessarily a determiner for the existence of God. It just isn't. But it is a gut-wrenching question. Because it's one thing to deal with the issue, as they would say, platonically. It's another thing if you've lost a close family member. Or someone is tragically lost, and you're sitting here, or someone gets shot in a drive-by shooting or something. How do you put that randomness and the insensibility of that act and connect that with a loving God. There's some debate in the universe as to whether or not there's randomness at all. Chuck talks about that a lot. He and I have been talking about it. It seems like even when you get down to the nuts and bolts of the universe, when you get way down to the bottom levels of quantum theory, everything is digitized. And so even randomness actually has a mathematical description to it. What that means, as R.C. Sproul would say, is not a chance. I asked him that one day when we were talking during a radio interview. I said, do you mean to tell me that you believe that God controls every single vibration of every molecule in the universe, of which there's something like 10 times something to the, I think, 48th. I can't remember. Don't quote me on it. And he said, yes. Einstein said, it seems like the whole universe is nothing but a thought in the mind of God. Now, that doesn't mean it's not real. It doesn't mean we're not here. It just means that's the nature of the substance that we are. So I decided to have a little fun. I mean, here you have this guy who's written a lot of books. He's a theologian. And I said, oh, well, that would mean that God is responsible for evil because, you see, if somebody shoots me, he keeps the bullet in existence that's going to hit me and kill me, right? You know, and I knew he'd have an answer for it. But he allows it. And why did he allow it? He allowed it in his wisdom. Because he who makes the universe makes the rules. But he does promise us that no matter what happens to us, all things work for good for those who love God, who are called according to his purpose. That's the guarantee. And to prove it, he dropped his son Jesus into the midst of all of the evil that was there and piled it all on his back. Now, Jesus didn't like the consequences. That's what the agony in the garden was all about. He didn't like the consequences. But God's will still had to go forward. You know, it's one of the few Christianity is unique in that area because Hinduism tries to relate it to the good or bad that you do and the karma that you have. Humanism, Marxism have never provided a satisfactory answer to it. Never. Every time we hear humanists ever talk about the issue of we should teach people how to have a meaningful life. Have you heard that one? This is the new definition, by the way, of what is human life. This is why it's dangerous. Okay, at one time God said all human life is sanctified. It's a gift. It is a creation of me. It must be preserved at all reasonable cost. That was the Judeo-Christian belief, until recently anyway. Theirs is meaningful life. Well, jeepers, who tells you what is meaning in life? And that's why we have started the legislative creep. First it started with abortion, now it's starting at the other end with euthanasia. I don't know why we worry about euthanasia, we should worry about youth in America. Well, anyway, we'll deal with that. It's all right. Okay, and now Holland being one of the first countries where at least it's halfway legal to suicide somebody. You know, it's a new verb we have coming into the English language. He's been suicided. Actually, a person commits suicide when he's killed and it's made to look like suicided, he's been suicided. This is a very popular maneuver in government for shady dealings. But now in Holland, let me tell you, this is actually happening. We already have, they have a pretty good number of documented cases where elderly people have been suicided. In other words, the family just decided we don't want to deal with them. They're a big burden, cost a lot of money on the state. So they arrange the paperwork and off goes mom and dad. People who are middle to late or middle to old age, when they're going into the hospital for surgery, they are hiring advocates, not really attorneys, but advocates who will be present, who will act as their representative while they're in the hospital to make sure they are not suicided while they are there. This is the marginal creep that we all keep talking about because this is happening in Holland today. And you can just watch it squeeze in from the outside. And who does it always attack first? It always attacks the very young and weak. It always attacks the old, the infirm, the mentally ill, those who are least capable of defending themselves. And then it begins to push inwards. Because where's the stopping point? If the values are all relative, if there are no absolute boundaries, if there is no thou shalt not, where does human life begin and end? And if that's what we're going to do, we should apologize to Hitler and Himmler and all of the people we tried at Nuremberg. Because the Holocaust was a legal event. That's something you need to remember. The Holocaust was a legal event. The Reichstag, the legitimate elected ruling body of Germany, declared that Jews and gypsies and other types were subhuman. It was a legal death, and the definitions in the Nazi legal machinery were incredibly precise. And all they did was define this whole group of people as being non-human, okay, or subhuman. You know, an Untermensch. Nietzsche talked about the Übermensch, which is the Superman. He was an existentialist. Okay, they were Untermenschen, people who were sort of subhuman. That's the floating definition. That's the creep that we face in this culture today. Now, as I started out by saying, this is a fight to the death. This is a fight to the death of the philosophy, so to speak. We have an ace up the sleeve. The ace up the sleeve is the fact that, and lo, I am with you all days, even to the end of the age, and that the gates of hell shall not prevail against the church. That doesn't mean the battle isn't going to get very intense. And you know what the consensus process has done? You know the hardest thing for people to do nowadays is to stand up. It's become real hard for people to stand up in the business place. Businesses are adopting all sorts of glop. They're putting people through psychological profile testing. They're putting people through consensus, total quality management training sessions, which are based totally on the Hegelian dialectic of brainwashing. It's the same process that was used by the Soviets to brainwash prisoners and people they wanted to bring over to their way of thinking. And it was brought into this country by a bunch of Marxists who fled from Nazi Germany. I guess it got a little hot for them in the 30s, Wilhelm Wundt and others. And they opened up shop here in the United States and began to push this whole system into the public school system. We get calls all the time for people telling us about these things, what they can say and they can't say. Now, fortunately, I'm noticing a change. Every once in a while, there's a little hope in the battle. I've noticed that, as Justice Thomas said, stand up. Stop tolerating this thuggery that has been imposed on us, that we can't say anything in the name of tolerance or loving or being mean-spirited or things like that. He said, be not afraid. It was brilliant because he actually said, this is the problem of the day. We're sick and tired of having people ram it down our throat. But there's also a cost to standing up and doing what you have to do. And remember, Jesus said, if you're not faithful in small things, the odds are you probably aren't going to be very good in the big things. See, it's in the small things that we develop the big character. That is where we're going, and I always remind people, darkness is a terrific place for light to shine. The last part of the book of Ephesians, when God talks about the armor of God, the line that always really strikes me is, and having done all, to stand. Number one, it's a fight. It is not a picnic. Number two, God in His grace and divine wisdom put you here in this time, this place, and this space. You are warriors, not spectators. Number three, the consequences are eternal for you and for everybody else. But number four, you're on the right side. And ultimately, having done all, we will stand. Lord God, please guard all of us as we go out today. Please remember those people that we are going to meet this week. Keep us in peace with them. Please remind us that even though we may not like them, we may even detest them, that our goal is to win them to you. Put the right words in our mouth that we may do that. And when we come to you at the end of our time, and we hear the words, well done, good and faithful servant. Thank you, Lord Jesus. Amen.
For a complete listing of materials to further enhance your personal Bible study, or to receive a free one-year subscription to Chuck Missler's monthly Christian Intelligence News Journal, Personal Update, contact Koinonia House at 1-800-KHOUSE1. That's 1-800-KHOUSE1. Or you can write to Koinonia House at P.O. Box D, Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, 83816-0347. To fax your correspondence, dial 208-773-6312.